listening to Women Who Change Tech, the podcast that gives you access to women who are contributing, inspiring, trailblazing, and disrupting the business of technology. We believe that when women inspire other women, amazing things happen. I'm your host, Allison Wade.
And I am your host, Jessie Sterenshoes, and we are connecting women around the world to share ideas that help us thrive and advance in our personal lives and in our careers.
Be sure to share this podcast with your friends, rate and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and help us bring Women Who Change Tech into the lives of more professionals.
Hold on to your seats as we give you a dose of inspiration from some of the most talented and creative women who are shifting the face of technology.
Hey, Jessie, how are you?
I am doing fantastic. How are you doing, Allison?
I'm good. I'm really excited that we're going to interview Dot Graham today. Dot has been such a phenomenon in the software testing world. I always say if there was a Hollywood Walk of Fame for software testers, Dot would have a star on it.
Aww.
She's been really instrumental in so many people's careers and lives, and she's got so much wisdom. And it just made me reflect today on how lucky I've known Dot since, I think it was 1995, and how lucky I am to have known her and so many other people in this industry. And just since you and I have been doing this podcast, the incredible women that we have met and talked to.
We are truly lucky. It's so interesting. I think when we got started, we were excited about the idea, and I remember us kind of brainstorming, what is it we want to put together and who is it we want to talk to? And it's just been even better than I think we could have imagined, just the kinds of conversations we've gotten to have, the insight, the people we've gotten to meet, and just the laughter too. Just every time we have these conversations with people, the hilarity.
Because we're so serious.
The hilarity mixed with the insight. So it's like the conversations are fun and funny, which I so appreciate.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, there's been some phenomenal women. And these are women that are making changes every single day in the world of technology. And I just love it. And in all different sectors too.
Mm-hmm.
All different sectors. Mm-hmm.
We are truly lucky.
We are very lucky. And Dot is no exception. So I can't wait to introduce you to Dot Graham today. Good morning, everybody. I'd like to introduce you to Dorothy Graham. She has been a lifelong friend of TechWell and has spoken at some 30 star conferences since 1992. I first met Dot in 1996. Her range of topics over the years have included psychology, reviews and collaboration, testing topics, and many, many talks on automation. Her first talk at Star 92 was Test is a Four-Letter Word, and her most recent tutorials are being Getting Started in Test Automation and Test Automation Patterns. At the recent Women Who Test conference day, her topics included testers, the three C's, criticism, communication, and confidence. Dot is the co-author of five books, Software Inspection and Foundations of Software Testing, and those four editions supporting the ISTQB qualification, and three books on automation, Software Test Automation, Experiences of Test Automation, and A Journey Through Test Automation Patterns. Dot is a mother and accomplished singer. She sings in three choir groups, and she's going to tell us more about her singing during the podcast. I have heard Dot sing, and she's just amazing. And I also think that Dot has been an incredible historian for us over the years. She keeps all kinds of trinkets from her conferences, and it's just amazing to see how things have evolved. So everybody join me in welcoming Dot this morning. Hi, Dot.
Hi.
Well, thanks very much. It's a great honor to be asked to take part in this podcast. And I'm really delighted to be here and to be chatting with you.
Excellent. Many, many people know you in software testing, but for the people that don't, can you tell us a little bit about your career over the years and just life over the years?
Okay. Well, I was born at a very early age. I was originally intended to be a school teacher, and I studied maths in college and I went to graduate school. But then I thought, well, all I've ever done has been in school, so maybe I should see what the real world is like. So I applied for a job and got it at Bell Labs in New Jersey. I was born in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and I went to Calvin College and Purdue University. And at Bell Labs, I got into testing quite by accident. They put me into a testing group, and my job as a programmer was to write a program to automate the testing, to run some tests, and then another program to compare the results. So I got into testing and test automation right from the start of my career. And this was in the early 70s. Well, by this time I'd married my husband, who's British, and after a little trip for 3 months to Alaska and back, then we emigrated to the UK. And I then worked at Ferranti Computer Systems for about 7 or 8 years, again, as a developer. But I was interested in testing, and nobody else seemed to be. I went independent when my daughter came along, and I decided to specialize in testing because it seemed to me that not many people were paying much attention to testing as a discipline. Mm-hmm. It was very much a Cinderella topic at the time. In fact, one of the things that happened, I was going around and collecting information actually about testing tools, and I was at a conference where there was an exhibition, and I was going around the development tool stands and saying, well, what support does your tool offer for testing? And one of the guys who I asked this question of looked at me and said, well, madam, if you buy this tool, you won't need to do any testing. And that was more or less the attitude.
I think there's still some of that attitude going on some days, well, Dot, but that's...
Unfortunately, yes, there is.
Yes.
Everyone always wants their silver bullet, don't they?
That's right.
What did you like about testing? What drew you in, madam?
Well, I mean, having been plonked in it from the start without sort of knowing anything about what it was, mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I mean, I decided to specialize in it because I could see that it had a lot of uses and it could be very valuable and it would save the users from things going wrong. Mm-hmm. When I was at Ferranti, which was my second job, mm-hmm. we were doing systems for UK police forces, and mm-hmm. people weren't particularly interested in testing, but I thought it was useful to do some testing. Mm-hmm. And the third project I was on, which was actually a very difficult project, mm-hmm. partly due to a contractual issue, which I could tell you about later if you like. Mm-hmm. But on that one, I actually drew up sort of more formal test plans. Well, I called them test plans. They were actually test specifications and just lists of test cases. And having those, that formality for the testing is what probably prevented that project from being an absolute disaster and made it only merely terribly difficult. But it did actually eventually go through.
I mean, my experience of you is that you have a tremendous eye for detail and an ear for detail, both of those things. So maybe perhaps that was something that drew you to testing. I'm just wondering if that was something to do with it.
I'm sure it is, yes. And I am definitely a nitpicker, as you've probably found out when I find mistakes on your website, as I do most people.
We love that. We love that about
That's the attitude.
Yeah.
And I think that I got that from my dad because he was a real stickler for grammar and spelling mm-hmm. and punctuation and things like that. So,
were you like that as a kid too? Like, do you remember being like that as a child? Like, really getting into details of things, being curious about that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think I've always liked sort of detailed things. I've also always liked miniatures. But I think that's partly because I'm very nearsighted, short-sighted. Ah. If I held something up that was really small and could hold it 3 inches from my eye, then I could see all the detail on it.
That's so interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
So, and do you see that similarity in testing?
Well, testers certainly need to have an eye for detail because a lot of testing does require looking into the dark corners of the software and thinking of things that other people don't think of.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Looking with intensity, right? Looking with 3 inches away from your face and really, really seeing it. Mm. I think that's amazing. You would describe yourself as a nitpicker, but at the beginning, and I always sort of say, this person is a woman who, and for you, I wrote down a woman who is an exceptional communicator. And I think that while you have that attention for detail, you always have a lovely way of presenting information to people. So I think that's what's so awesome about you. Is that so? I would never call you a nitpicker.
You're too polite.
Yes. No,
well,
not
I suppose
at all.
Somebody once called me an entertainer when I was doing a lot of training. I used to think of myself as a funnel because I like to do a lot of reading and research, and I pick up ideas wherever I find them. And I think of myself as a funnel catching lots of ideas from lots of different places and then sort of filtering them down and distilling them so that they could be applied or given to people in the best possible way.
I keep picturing like a sifter, like when you sift through things and then things fall out through that, you know, and you catch what you need to catch before it comes out the other end.
And sort of discarding the things that aren't going to be relevant for a particular person or situation.
So when you said you were working on the police force project, what impact do you feel like you had on that project by working on that?
Well, I was responsible for the program that handled the incidents. So the calls would come in from the public and various means from other police forces and so on. And then a policeman would be assigned to go and investigate it. A police car would be sent out or whatever. And whatever follow-up was needed, anything that would go into that, the report of that particular incident. So I was responsible for the software that did the incident processing. So it's fairly important stuff.
That is super important. Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite critical.
And I know the program that I worked on, there was one bug that I never did figure out what was wrong. It occasionally put the stuff twice on the screen. I mean, it wasn't a major showstopper, but it was really annoying that I never did figure out what had gone wrong. And I met somebody who I worked with, and they told me somebody else had figured it out and fixed it. So I was pleased to hear that. I don't think I was a particularly good programmer, by the way. I used to make a lot of bugs, but I used to enjoy fixing them.
That's awesome. So I know that you've done, you said 400 presentations over the years and spoken at 250 major conferences. And the question that you hear most often is, please tell me, what is the best tool? Yes. And I would love to hear what you say to that, because that's what people want to know. They want, tell me the shortcut, tell me where to go, tell me how to fix this, especially in automation.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about that?
Give me that silver bullet.
Yes.
Well, when people say, well, I mean, I wish I had a penny for every time somebody asked me what's the best tool, I'd be rich. But the problem is, that's the wrong question. Well, I mean, let me ask another question. What's the best car? Now, if you shut your eyes and think, what car would you like? Price is no object. You have just won a car. You can have any car that you want. What's in your mind at the moment? Is it a shiny, bright red Ferrari? I dare say for some people it probably would be. But if you're my son-in-law, it might be a Model T Ford or an ancient Austin Martin, because he's a classic car buff, or an old Volkswagen bus.
Tesla for me.
Oh, right. Okay. Yep. Yes. That would be an interesting one. But if you've got, say, five children and two dogs, neither of those alternatives
are very safe.
So it depends. That's the thing is, it's not the question of what's the right car, but what's the right car for you. So it's not a question of what's the right tool, but what's the right tool for you? What do you want to accomplish with it? What are your objectives? You shouldn't be buying a tool just because it's fashionable to have a tool. There should be something that you want to get out of it, which is realistic, achievable, and is going to give you a business benefit. And then you might think, is a tool the right way to address that problem? Because it might not be. There might be better ways to address it. And if a tool is the right answer, then you can begin looking at what tool, but first of all, what type of tool, and what the lots of other factors to take into account.
Yeah, I think that we hear the word shelfware way too often, right? Because people do think something is fashionable, or they're looking to solve a problem, but they don't really understand their own environment and their own processes. And so they buy a bright, shiny tool, and then it only serves to make things more complicated and less usable for the testers.
I've known someone where they bought a particular tool and didn't do the right things with it, didn't consider the testware architecture or maintainability or anything like that. And after a year or two, they said, oh, this tool's no good. We'll get another one. So they got another tool in with the same, exactly the same approach, ended up with exactly the same result. So they said, this tool's no good either. Let's get another one in. And guess what happened with the third tool? Same thing.
Yeah.
So it's not the tool.
Well, that's interesting. You said that you've been in automation for 50 years and that your talk, Blunders in Test Automation, has always been like incredibly popular. And I guess that's because there are a lot of blunders in test automation, right?
There are, yeah. I mean, the the blunders talk, which I really enjoy doing, the very first blunder and the root of a lot of the others is that testing tools actually don't test. They just run stuff. They don't do testing. Testing is far more than what a tool does. And when
you've
people
just
are talking
my mind.
When people talk about tools, they're usually talking about test execution tools. And that's just running something that they've already been told. They're not thinking of what to test. They're not thinking of what would the users want to do here. They're not thinking what could go wrong. They're just thinking, oh, I have a script. Here it goes. Bang, it's quick. Mm. Look at me. Aren't I amazing? So tools don't do testing. They're very quick at doing one aspect of one part of testing. And they are useful because of that. But they don't do everything.
Right. And that's actually interesting with relationship to AI, because is AI just going to make that more pervasive, do you think?
AI will be able to do things much faster and do things that are difficult to do by humans at the moment, but it won't do everything.
Mm-hmm.
Computers do not think.
Right.
Artificial intelligence is not intelligent.
Right.
It's artificial, but it's not intelligent in the way that humans are intelligent. Was it Arthur C. Clarke? Any form of technology sufficiently advanced is indistinguishable from magic.
Mm.
People are thinking that AI is going to be magic now.
Mm.
But there have been a lot of things over the years that people thought were magic.
Absolutely.
So what are the things that women should be focused on? What are the things, the types of skills that we should be continuing to work on that AI and these tools just will never do, that we should be continuing to do and do better and think about?
Yeah, one of the things that's happening now is that a lot of testers are being encouraged or pushed into becoming technical and writing code. Mm-hmm. And I can see this happening, and I know it's not going to stop because I object to it, although I do. But I think one of the problems there is that people may well forget the skills of testing. Mm. And testing is a skill. I mean, the tester's mindset is the key asset that any tester has. And you can take someone who is a developer and encourage them to do better testing, but they probably will never do testing as well as a tester who's had lots of experience and has a real tester's mindset will do. Mm-hmm. And you can take a tester and they can understand code, they can write code. They may not be as good as a developer at writing code because it's a different mindset. It's a different skill. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to merge those two. And by trying to force all of the testers to write code, you're going to have people writing code who don't do it well, maybe don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have all the developers writing the tests, you're having people write tests who perhaps don't want to and don't do it well.
Right.
So I think it's important to retain the distinction between testing and coding. And of course, automation is a coding job. It's not a testing job. That's one of the problems. That's one of the blunders that people assume, because we called it a testing tool, that it's something that testers need to use directly.
Right.
But if you're not doing testing well, if your testing is in chaos, then if you automate chaos, you just get faster chaos.
Yeah, absolutely. So to Jesse's question, now you've obviously been a female in the tech industry, sort of luckily the ratios are getting a little bit better, but you started out in the early days when the ratios weren't as good as they are now. And then even though we still know they have a long way to go, being a woman in this industry, what sorts of things have you found that, you know, have you encountered any hindrances? Have you had to sort of learn and readjust and do things differently maybe than a man would have? What have you sort of done?
Yes. Well, I think one thing, and thinking back to my very first job at Bell Labs, one thing that just struck me recently, actually, when I was thinking about it, is, I mean, I was always very keen to do a good job. I wanted to do the best work I could. I had a great boss for my first boss. I'm still in touch with him, Chris Viscars, and I saw him a couple of years ago. And I remember at Bell Labs, if we went down for lunch, for example, sometimes I would sit at a table full of women. And the other women didn't seem to be that keen as I was, or maybe that driven, to do a good job and to be really interested in the work. And the conversation would be about interior decorating or fashion, which, to be honest, I didn't have my own house at the time, and I've never been particularly interested in fashion. And sometimes I would sit with the men, and the conversations there were much more interesting. Now, I don't know, it's probably part of the culture. This was 1970, remember?
Right.
And the expectation was still that women might not be working after they had children. So the women weren't, I suppose, as serious about their careers as I think women are today, because there's an assumption today that if you have a career, you will continue working, whatever your home situation is.
Right.
So that was an interesting thing. And I also felt at Bell Labs that I had to sort of fight for my position. There was a lot of teasing about women's lib and things like that. And I had, look at my work. So that's what's important.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I did get promoted and that was good. But then after we went to the UK and I worked for Franti, I joined a team then. I think I was the only woman in the team. But I just found it so much easier. I was just accepted as one of the lads. And there was none of this, oh, you're a woman kind of thing. It was just, oh, can you do this? Oh, yeah, okay. What do you think about this? And it was just, I was one of the team. And it was a really great team to work with. In the 7 or 8 years that I spent with that team, with most of the same people all of that time, they were a really good bunch to work with.
Yeah, that's interesting that you said, look at my work. And that's really what it's all about, isn't it? And if you focus in on the comments that you may get and those sorts of things, I'm sure you had to have somewhat of a thick skin back then and try to let some of those comments just roll off your back and let your work and speak for itself.
Mm. Yeah. And when I became independent as well, I mean, one thing I'm very sure about, and that is that I would never have had the wonderful career that I've had if I had stayed employed.
Ah,
interesting. Because, I mean, although I did enjoy the work at Franti, the thing that actually made me leave was they were going to do a training course for somebody. And I'd trained as a teacher and I wanted to do this training course. But when I asked about it, they said, oh, no, we've got a man to do that. and that made me furious.
Mm-hmm.
But so I then decided, there were some other factors as well, but I then decided to leave and become independent. But of course, my daughter arrived about then as well. So then that also made me become an independent. But I'm sure my career has been much better for having been independent than if had I stayed employed.
So that's interesting. So in your mind, was that like a strategic move? I need to do this strategically for my career. Was this just a little bit of, I'll show them, I'll go and learn how to teach a class?
There might well have been some of that, yes, because I then went to the National Computing Center and went into a group that was providing training.
Did you get to drive past Ferenti when you did that? That's always the best when you can drive right past people.
No, it's because like I took the train in.
Oh, okay.
I remember having great satisfactions in some areas of my life about those sorts of things. My earliest memory was in teaching when my degree is in early childhood education, and I had a particularly obnoxious teacher who told my parents, I'm continuously having to push Allison back into the curriculum, which tells you a little bit about my personality. I was jumping around all over the place. And then my mother insisted that I get an appraisal, like an IQ test. And she was proven wrong, but she told my mother, well, maybe she'll get some sort of job. Who knows? Maybe they'll give her a job at the post office or whatever. And I remember when I was in college and going to the library to get some books, she actually happened to be standing behind me in line. And I turned and saw her, and I was taking a lot of books on child psychology out of the library and everything like that. And the woman said, oh, you know, you're not allowed to borrow that many books. And I turned and looked at her and said, yes, I am, because I have a teacher's library card. I looked at this woman with disdain to make sure she was very aware that I was at least at her level and possibly going to exceed her.
That's awesome.
Yes.
Those moments are the best.
They really are. They really are.
They're so sweet.
Well, I think one other thing I was going to say, when I first started going to conferences and when I was as an independent, I remember one of the first ones I went to was very interesting. And I had a number of questions that I wanted to ask. And I put my hand up and he called on somebody else. And I kept my hand up and he called on somebody else, all men, by the way. And the whole time I was thinking, hang on, I'm here, you know, I want to know something. I'm sure my question's better than that. Well, maybe it wasn't, but it was certainly equal. but I didn't, he never did pick on, choose me to answer my question. And rather than think, oh, there's so many men here, their ideas are much better than mine, and sort of collapsing inward, I got mad. I said, no, this isn't right. And then when I first started doing speaking engagements as well, I had to be quite pushy in terms of, I will give a presentation at this seminar. Obviously, I always wanted to do a good job as well and did my utmost to provide useful information in a way which was as entertaining as possible.
So you said that you've always had this kind of innate confidence, which you attribute, I think, to your father. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think my dad had a lot to do with it because he always was very supportive of me and what I did. It didn't treat me any different than the boys. But one thing he did suggest to me that turned out to be very useful, although it wasn't really put in that way at the time, was when I was still in high school. He said, well, why don't you take a typing class? That then if all else fails, then you can maybe be a secretary. That's sort of equivalent to you, or maybe you could work in the
post office with sorting letters, yes.
But in fact, it turned out to be a good idea because my dad suggested it partly because he'd had to teach himself to touch type. It did turn out to be a useful skill.
Yeah, because in computer science, typing fast is really important.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about the three C's. You've done this talk at Women Who Test, and I found this to be like a masterclass in things like you talk about criticism, in confidence. And what's the third C? The third C is?
It's criticism, communication, and confidence, yeah.
There you go. So can you tell us just a little bit about those principles that you use and how you go about teaching those things? Because those are the things I think that really make us great at life and great employers and employees.
Yes, well, I actually put that the beginnings of that presentation together quite a long time ago. I've always been interested in psychology as well. Excuse me. And so I put it together and I sort of showed it to somebody and they didn't think it was very good. And so I completely lost confidence in it and put it away for a few years. And then when I dug it out again, I thought, well, hang on a minute. And I had some more ideas by then. And the idea of the criticism, as testers, we are, in a sense, critics. We are criticizing other people's work. We're criticizing the developer's work. And the way you give criticism is, I think, very important. You can be constructive about giving criticism. But even if you are as constructive as you think you're being, as constructive as possible, people don't always take it in that way. So I actually start the talk by talking about receiving criticism and thinking about how do you feel when you're criticized, to put people, put yourself in someone else's shoes. And there is a script that you can follow. It's DASR, where you describe what's happened, you say how it had affected you, you ask for a specific action and you reinforce their worth. And if you follow that sort of script when you're giving a criticism, it makes it a lot more of a validating experience for the person you're criticizing, makes the criticism much more effective.
Yeah, we actually did a little role play during the talk, which was amazing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was in the communication part because there were different ways of communicating. And one of them is push style and pull style. And a push style is assuming that you know best and you're telling somebody something. And pull style is asking a question instead of telling them, but drawing the truth out. And that was what we had a little role play with different people having little different scripts to use to illustrate it.
So can you give me an example of how that works? Since I wasn't at the conference, I'd love to hear how it works.
Okay. Well, supposing you really need some extra time for testing. If the push style would be, you go to your boss and you say, hey, boss, I have to tell you something. We have to have 3 weeks for testing. 2 weeks isn't enough. And the boss will say, what? 3 weeks? That's ridiculous. In fact, development's running a bit late. I'm afraid you can only have 1 week. Though that didn't work too well, did it? Now, the pull style is, you go up to your boss and you say, excuse me, boss, I'd like to ask you a question. I know we've got 2 weeks scheduled for testing, but we are having some problems, and we may not be able to test as thoroughly as we should in that time. And I just want to ask you whether it's okay to take that risk, because I remember in another project, we didn't test as thoroughly as we should. And then when these bugs got through, because we hadn't found them in testing, we did lose that major customer. Do you remember that? Is that okay to take that risk? And that approach is much more likely to get a positive response.
Nice. I love that.
Yeah, I think that obviously the big difference is that you're asking instead of demanding, and you're getting their buy-in and their involvement, right?
So you're not telling them what the answer should be, although you know what it is. You're relating it to something that's more important to them, because the manager's more concerned with risks, or for example, relating it to deadlines. And therefore, you're coming onto their, you're asking them, this is what, how it's going to affect you. And you're lining it up with their concerns.
Mm. And it becomes more like of a collaborative conversation.
Exactly. Yeah.
I love it.
Dot, there's a book that you highly recommend too during that talk. And can you tell us a little bit about that book? It's The Confidence Code, I believe.
That's right. Yes. In fact, listening to some of the other podcasts, some of the things that were mentioned by other people, particularly Angie Jones and Don Jardine, were very closely related to things that are addressed in this book. And I'd highly recommend every woman to read this book. It's called The Confidence Code. It's by Kathy Kay and Claire Shipman. And just one example, a page open at random, they did a study and they found that women working at HP applied for promotions only when they believed they met 100% of the qualifications necessary for the job. The men were happy to apply when they thought they would meet 60% of the requirements. So essentially, women feel confident only when we are perfect or practically perfect.
Yes.
And it makes
in every way. Isn't that a song from Mary Poppins?
Oh, yeah.
Practically perfect in every way.
They also make the point that the thing that actually sways people's opinions is not their knowledge, but their confidence. They've done studies at universities and things like that, where people who knew more but weren't confident about putting it across, didn't put it across confidently, were not believed or that did not sway opinions. But people who very confidently said something which was wrong were the ones who were believed, the ones who had the influence. So confidence is really important in the work environment. And the one thing in this book, which was a revelation to me, is that gaining confidence is not so much to do with being affirmed, like having a mentor and that kind of thing, although that does help, and not so much in gaining knowledge, but it's just in taking action and in letting your failures not set you back. And this is something that men tend to do much better than women.
Yeah, I think it's about being, you know, taking those risks and then being prepared to accept the outcome. If you fail, you're not devastated. You move on and learn from it. And that's part of obtaining confidence. That's always been part of the way I obtain confidence.
Mm, that's it.
What about you, Jess?
Don't be afraid to fail.
Hmm.
What about you, Jess?
Well, I think there are ways to work on getting comfortable with being confident, with having a background in improv, that's something that's really helped me doing improv games my whole life. I think you work on that as a technique. And I think people don't realize that is something you can actually work on, that if it doesn't come naturally to you, there are exercises and games that can help you get better at those skills. Some people are naturally confident, or like Dot said, they have somebody at home that helps them with confidence, but a lot of people aren't naturally confident, and there are ways to work on those skills and safely work on them in environments to kind of build up your confidence, which is a nice thing to know.
And I also need to say that one of the things that has helped me tremendously in my career is having a totally supportive and totally wonderful husband.
Yeah.
He's always been totally supportive of my work, and he's just been wonderful. We're going to celebrate our 50th anniversary this summer.
That's wonderful. Awesome. Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, Roger is awesome. He is absolutely awesome.
Nice. Yeah,
that's really terrific. And speaking of that kind of time lapse, Dot, you're going to retire from STAR this year. This is going to be your last conference in the US, you said, right?
I'm planning for this to be my last STAR East. I don't quite dare say it's definitely my last. Roger says, don't completely close the door.
Oh, I love it.
And I am doing another one in the States in September, but as it's a competitor, I guess I'm not allowed to mention that.
Yes, no, of course you're not.
What?
There are no competitors, Scott.
But I'm planning on this being my last year of working. I mean, it'll be 50 years next spring since I started work at Bell Labs.
Wow.
I'll be 75 years old. I'm amazed I've still been going. I mean, the last 10 years has been wonderful because I've basically just gone to conferences. I retired from Grove 10 years ago. I mean, I really enjoyed a lot of the time at Grove, but it was time to go then. But the last 10 years have just been great because all I've done is go to conferences, which I've always loved doing anyway. So it's been great. But now our lives are changing. We've downsized. We've moved house. Our son is now independent. Our daughter and her husband are doing well. And it's time to take a more relaxed view, do more holidays.
Yes, garden and sing, right, Dot?
Yeah, more singing.
More singing, yes, yes. So tell us quickly, if you would, about your singing career, because you're doing some amazing things with your singing.
Well, I think I've sung all my life. I know my mother sang to me even when I was a baby. I was trying to sing back. And I've sung in choirs all my adult life. I sing with a number of... I've sung with the Halle Choir, which is quite a big choir. In the States, I sang with the Pro Art Chorale, and I've sung in Carnegie Hall. And here I sang in the Proms once with the Halle Choir. Now I sing with some smaller choirs. There's the William Byrd Singers, which is a chamber choir. I'm having a year out now, but hope to go back next year. I sing with a group which goes on tour every 2 years, John Paul Singers. We went to Lithuania in October. I sing with a group, a local choir, Wellington Festival Choir. I sing with a small group, magical group of about 12 called Little Morton Singers, and a group of 6 of us who have been singing together for about over 30 years called Convivia. We sing one to a part just to get together and just sing music that we bring along or read new music and that sort of thing, mainly 16th century stuff.
And what part do you sing?
I'm a soprano, usually second soprano. I've got a low speaking voice. Mm-hmm. But my singing voice is a high voice.
Huh, how interesting.
Strange, yeah.
Yeah, it is strange, isn't it? I didn't realize that. I mean, I've heard you sing, so I know that you have a high voice when you sing, but I hadn't made the correlation that you have a low speaking voice, but a high singing voice.
Well, when I was at...
Do you like to sing a cappella?
Yes, I like singing a cappella. I like singing one to a part. I'm quite happy to sing on my own, in fact. When I was at school, I was in a girls' sextet, and I sang second alto. And then when I auditioned for the senior high school choir, the conductor said, you're not an alto, you're a soprano. So I went from second alto to first soprano.
Somebody had you pegged wrong.
And loved it.
Yeah. Nice.
That's awesome. And so singing just takes you away. That's what you like about it, Don?
It reaches the parts other things don't reach. It really sort of transports me. And I love singing. It's just... very rewarding. It brings me great joy. I'm very thankful for that gift. Don't know how long it will continue because voices don't last forever, but at the moment it seems to be doing okay, touch wood.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Well, we're getting towards the end of this podcast, and I want to say thank you to Dot for being here today, and thank you for all of your contributions over the years to software testing. You've been an amazing mentor to me and to many, many women and to many people in general who are struggling with automation and struggling with other things around their testing career. And we really appreciate you.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a real privilege and a joy to be involved with TechWell and SQE and everybody there over the years. I've had such wonderful experiences, wonderful friends I've made. They're amazing things that I've learned. And if I've been able to help people, then that's absolutely the best thing. So thank you so much. And thank you for inviting me to do this podcast.
Thanks, Dot. Well, that was a super incredible conversation that we had with Dot. I really loved all of her stories and her experiences from her career. I think one of my favorite stories was when she was talking about working for the UK police force and being a tester for them. Thought it was really interesting how she was a tester working on a lot of their incidents, I don't know why, but I guess I didn't think about equating being a tester for the police. You know, you think about being a tester in all these different industries, but I guess that's incredibly important. I just hadn't thought about, you know.
Yeah, that's what we call critical software, right? Because if it doesn't work, somebody can die.
Exactly. So it was interesting to hear her perspective on that and her experiences there. I thought that was really, really neat. Another thing I liked is when she talked about her being called like a nitpicker or her attention to detail, and that she likes to think of herself as a funnel.
Yeah.
And so for me, I'm a really visual thinker. So that gave me this really interesting image of a tester that I like, this person who kind of catches things. And so I had this really interesting image of a sifter and catching like these grains of information or bugs before they go through the sifter. And so if you're like churning things back and forth, you're catching the bugs before they go out into the world. And for whatever reason, that idea of the funnel, the sifter, just really was a great visual for me to understand.
Yeah, it's such a positive reframe too. Mm-hmm. If you're like, I'm not a nitpicker, I'm just a funnel. I'm just doing you a service here. It's awesome.
Yeah, it really was. What did you think about when she was talking about confidence and getting confidence from her father?
I love that. I love Dot's 3 C's talk. It's been so helpful to so many people. And the confidence is key in that talk.
Absolutely. I love that she said she got the confidence from her father, but that she understands that some women have a lot of confidence and some don't. And so she wants to give women who don't maybe have a lot of confidence the tools and help them and give them those things to gain confidence.
Yeah, it's definitely a practical how-to guide.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What were some of the things you liked?
Well, I think one of the quintessential things that I loved about this talk is that Dot has written books on automation, and she's taught so many classes on automation. And I thought she gave us kind of the 101 that everybody needs to know. So when she answered the question that she says is so commonly asked by her, and that is, what is the best tool to use? And I just think it's really, I think we should replay the answer that she gave because it's the truth. And sometimes nobody wants to hear the truth, but the answer is it depends. But I love the way that she framed it in terms of car shopping and how people should make their decisions and that there is no right answer and how you figure that out. The question that you hear most often is, please tell me, what is the best tool? Yes. And I would love to hear what you say to that, because that's what people want to know. They want, tell me the shortcut, tell me where to go, tell me how to fix this, especially in automation.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about that?
Give me that silver bullet.
Yes.
Well, when people say, well, I mean, I wish I had a penny for every time somebody asked me, what's the best tool? I'd be rich. But the problem is, that's the wrong question. Well, I mean, let me ask another question. What's the best car? Now, if you shut your eyes and think, what car would you like? Price is no object. You have just won a car. You can have any car that you want. What's in your mind at the moment? Is it a shiny, bright red Ferrari? I dare say for some people it probably would be. But if you're my son-in-law, it might be a Model T Ford or an ancient Austin Martin, because he's a classic car buff, or an old Volkswagen bus.
Tesla for me.
Oh, right. Okay. Yep. Yes. That would be an interesting one. But if you've got, say, 5 children and 2 dogs, neither of those alternatives are really safe. So it depends. That's the thing is, it's not the question of what's the right car, but what's the right car for you? So it's not a question of what's the right tool, but what's the right tool for you? What do you want to accomplish with it? What are your objectives? You shouldn't be buying a tool just because it's fashionable to have a tool. There should be something that you want to get out of it, which is realistic, achievable, and is going to give you a business benefit. And then you might think, is a tool the right way to address that problem? Because it might not be. There might be better ways to address it. And if a tool is the right answer, then you can begin looking at what tool, but first of all, what type of tool, and what the lots of other factors to take into account.
You've been listening to Women Who Change Tech, the podcast that connects you to extraordinary women for deep, inspiring conversations.